way we perceive our universe. And then the other rationale for trying to go beyond four dimensions is that if we accept string theory is a means of quantizing gravity, then we tend to get led to a more general dimensional space-time, sort of typically either 10 or 11 dimensional. So trying to understand what happens to higher dimensional geometries therefore kind of becomes relevant to understanding, say, the very early universe, or indeed depending on the type of ways in which you hide those extra dimensions, because obviously they've got to be hidden, we don't see them. They could even have implications for our universe now, a late time universe. So that's, if you like, the sort of two reasons why we're going to take a look at what happens if we go beyond four dimensions in gravity. So I've already kind of done this. When I looked at this domain wall, I computed the curvature of a metric, which I wrote. In this form. So I kind of wrote it like that, but I didn't make any assumptions about how many dimensions the X space had. I just said, suppose you've got this space here such that if I deleted anything to do with Z, what's left is a D minus one dimensional manifold. So here, this was some arbitrary lower dimensional manifold. And so we found that computing the curvature was actually relatively straightforward. So I'm just going to summarize what we saw. So with relatively little cost, we'd found the Ricci tensor of this arbitrary dimensional space-time, and the only kind of constraint that it had is that it sort of splits into 1 plus d minus 1 dimensions, where in this case, if A varies, the dependence on this Z dimension is kind of coherent, and this lower dimensional hypersurface sort of has a distance that scales as you move in the extra dimension. So if I took, for example, the most trivial thing I could do with A, which is just to say A equals 1, then is an Einstein manifold, RZZ is 0, and R mu nu, I keep calling it mu nu because that's what I've got in my notes, so I think I called it alpha beta when I did it on the board, and the Ricci tensor in the D minus 1 dimensions is just the same as the Ricci tensor of gamma. So if our gamma metric solves the vacuum Einstein equations, then I can just add an extra flat dimension and get a solution to higher dimensional Einstein equations. So it sort of feels almost like a cheat. All we do is we take an Einstein manifold and add an extra direction, but, you know, that's at least saying that we can start to make sense of solutions in higher dimensions. And the simplest one that we could do that would have some non-trivial behavior would be the black string, which is Schwarzschild in four dimensions, just simply adding an extra flat direction. So here, if I follow that process, I'd start off with my Schwarzschild in four dimensions. And just add an extra direction.
In this case, is R alpha z zero?
Yes, it is. Because it's a very, it's kind of a very clean splitting in that case of the metric. So if I look at my five-dimensional metric by taking Schwarzschild and just adding a dz squared, and then I look at what happens as r goes to 2gm, I've got all of that machinery that we showed for the Schwarzschild black hole. So we know that's still a coordinate singularity. It's still looking like an event horizon, because the only thing the extra, you know, if you think about a null geodesic, the only thing that this extra dimension does is kind of add an extra conserved quantity. So the null geodesic could have some momentum in the z direction, but still, if we ask where is the boundary of things we can see, then the radial geodesics coming purely out at fixed z are going to be exactly the same. So our event horizon is in exactly the same place, and it was a two-sphere in four dimensions, so now it's a two-sphere times the extra direction, the z direction. So that looks like a string, so it's called the black string. And obviously, if I took just a single direction and took it to being a whole set of different directions, we would get something that was now extended in all of those n directions, and that's called a brain. So that would give us just a simple black brain. So we sort of got the feeling that we haven't really done very much so far, but at least we've sort of verified that we can construct geometries in higher dimensions. So what we kind of like to do is to see what's unique or to four dimensions, what's different. So, I mean, actually, we've already, even though this was cheap, we've already shown that there's something different about higher dimensions. In four dimensions, in vacuum, the only topology that we can have for a black hole is spherical. So, I mean, I mentioned, okay, forget about ADS for the moment, but if we're in vacuum, a black hole has to be a hole. It has to be something spherical. But once we go above four dimensions, we're now seeing that a black hole doesn't have to be hyperspherical. We can have extended black objects. So we've kind of already found a difference. It perhaps isn't surprising, but it's nonetheless one to note. It's something a little bit different from what was going on in four dimensions. But so far, all that construction has done is said, let's take an n-dimensional Einstein manifold and push it up to n plus 1. Yep?
So the fact that four-dimensional black objects have to be white-white is a consequence of the fact that lower dimensional gravity is too simple to have black holes?
I mean, there's all sorts of different ways that you could actually intuit the fact that they have to be spherical. I mean, in essence, you end up showing it by looking at the exact solutions to Einstein gravity, in essence, right? And you see that, I mean, the obvious thing to try would be a cylindrical black hole, as you say. It's not quite as simple as saying that you're building a four-dimensional solution from a three-dimensional solution, because there's always, there can be, in this case there isn't, but there can be crosstalk between adding another dimension. But it's not unrelated either, right? Because obviously, if we could have a black hole in three dimensions, asymptotically vacuum, then we could have just built one in four. Mm-hmm. For, you're looking ahead to something I want to talk about later. For isolated black holes, yes, but for these objects, whereas sort of in terms of just simple breathing modes, there would be an area theorem. In fact, something rather interesting happens when you start thinking about the entropy of black strings versus black holes. So it's not so straightforward. I've said there's a solution. I haven't said anything about whether it's stable. Just said it exists. So if I've built a black brain in more dimensions, the legitimate question would be, well, is that the only one you can build, or can you build arbitrary? This one is something that is a four-dimensional metric product with a single extra dimension. Can I build things that are more complicated, say a four-dimensional object living in a seven-dimensional space-time, and so on. So what I want to do now is therefore to build just in a very simple way. Something that's a little bit more, has a little bit more going on. So here, what I've done is I've really just taken that initial wall-type metric and I've tacked on an extra space here. So here, I could say that this is going to have p dimensions, and I'll say that this one has m dimensions. So it's, if I had something, say this was a spherical space, so I was drawing an analogy between this gamma and the d omega squared, then this would be like a hyperspherical black hole. So its topology would be Sm rather than S2. And then if I look at this part, because this has p directions, you would sort of see that it's, this black hole was kind of translated in those p minus 1 spatial directions. So this sort of gives a candidate for building some quite generic extended object in higher dimensions. Mm-hmm. Yes. So in this case, we're just looking, we want to have B and D dimensions where one of them is time. So I'm kind of sticking to my sort of simple causal Lorentzian type of space. But I'm doing, I mean, the what I want to highlight here is, first of all, you know, how you build solutions together, but also the work that we've done so far in thinking about how we construct Ricci tensors, we can actually, we're going to sort of write down the curvature of this metric without doing an awful lot of work. And so this is kind of where the payoff starts to come from this whole formalism. Because in this case, if this g mu nu just depends on x, and whoops, this should be y, I think. Don't want to have two sets of x's. And this gamma depends on y, quite often a lot of the useful or interesting metrics that we want to deal with in if you're doing sort of string supergravity can be expressed in this form. Now, gamma might be really horrendous, but we at this level, where we don't mind. We're just sort of saying that this is its own space that talks to itself, and this talks to itself. So that's kind of where we're starting, and we're seeing, can we sort of build something from this space-time? So we know how to do the first bit, and actually we know how to, if we deleted this bit, we also know how to do the last bit, because it's just this analytically continued to a Euclidean space. So the only thing we have to think about is how the two come together. So it's sort of clear that sort of G and gamma, if you like, so when I'm looking for the connection, it's sort of obvious that this bit doesn't talk to that bit. If you remember when we looked at a spherically symmetric metric, we had a dt squared and we had the d omega squared, and the only connection components for the time were t and r. They never mixed with the theta pieces. And so it's exactly the same here, just more dimensions. And so I can essentially just write down what I expect. So I don't even have to do the differentiation. I kind of know what it's going to be because I look at what happened up there for the domain wall. So that allows me to read off these separately. And then I know from my experience with looking at, say, the spherically symmetric metric, that there's no mixing between the mu and the alpha indices at the level of the connection. So you can check that this actually works if I set p equal to 1, n equal to 2, and did that Schwarzschild, or, you know, the spherically symmetric metric. Most of the two forms So we can again read off most of the two forms without doing any work. So the ones involving T, mu and nu, I can essentially lift off from what I did with the domain wall, and they'll be the same as this, but with C replaced with A. So I can just put that in brackets. C by A, and of course the alpha and beta indices become mu and nu indices. And so it's like saying that, well, okay, you know, if I try to find out what my curvature tensor is, I can, if I stick with the mu nu space, I've got the same. If I stick with the alpha beta space, I've got the same. The mu talking to R is the same. The alpha talking to R is the same. And there's only one other thing that I have to think about, and that is whether the mu's talk to the alphas at the level of the curvature. And we kind of expect that they do because we've got a theta mu r and a theta alpha r. So in the theta wedge theta piece of the curvature 2 form, we'll pick up an extra term there. So by just sort of stepping back and thinking a little bit about how that Cartan formalism will go through with this sort of composite metric, we've got to the point of getting the curvature two forms very quickly without really having to do any work. We've just lifted things off the shelf, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. There's one question. There is theta mu r proportional to omega r, and then there's theta alpha r.
Oh, that's, sorry, you're right. That should be a mu. Thanks for spotting that. Yeah, that should be a mu. Yeah, thank you. Are all the others look plausible? Yeah. Let's just see, is that... No, it is a mu in the notes, it's just me writing it down wrong. So... So I'm just writing down this was what I calculated just the other day when I did the domain wall, and nothing really has changed, but I sort of see from the patterns that, you know, my Riemann, that like everything within the X space, the Riemann is the same as I calculated initially. Everything within the Y space is essentially swaps A and C. And then if I now look at the cross terms, you can see that the mu R pieces are going to be what they were before. So it's almost, so far, nothing has talked to, there isn't any crosstalk. And then the new piece is what you get from having taken these two different spaces and bolted them together. So putting it all together, sorry, I called that M, didn't I, not N? So in the end, I've managed to find the curvature of that geometry sort of with fairly little work. What it is when you sort of bolt spaces together, you kind of inherit the curvature of the background. So that piece is always in there. Then you inherit terms that tell you how that space distorts as you move in, say, that in this case it depends on R, in the radial direction. So that's kind of these pieces. And then finally, you get a term in the curvature whereby the first block, the X block, talks to the Y block. So that's these cross terms there. So it's all, it all kind of slots together. It's a bit like, you know, building blocks. And so this gives us building blocks for constructing higher dimensional solutions. So I just like to use that to talk about what does a black hole look like in higher dimensions. So let's have a look at an example, higher dimensional Schwarzschild. So in this case, if we want a black hole or a Schwarzschild solution, something that's just isolated, a point-like object, that tells me I want p equal to 1. I just want to have a simple a squared of r dt squared. And then, of course, m is going to be just d minus 2. So the black hole surrounded by a d minus 2 sphere. Mm-hmm.
The n and the r mu u should be
m. Thanks. I'm obviously full of typos this morning. Okay, so this is what I want. I want to take the Schwarzschild solution, but just throw it up into more dimensions. So that was why I didn't specify what the gamma or the g mu nu were, because it now allows me to say, well, you know, the y space could be a sphere. It could be positively curved. It could just be flat, but that doesn't mean to say that it's r to the n. It could be something else that was flat. Or it could be negatively curved. By writing it in this format, keeping things just a tiny bit more general, we've actually got to a point where we can build solutions that are actually potentially quite complicated. So in this case, this is picking, in terms of when we first did our spherically symmetric metric, we've kind of picked the gauge in which R is the proper radial distance. Now, that might not be the best gauge that, to use in terms of finding an analog to a higher dimensional black hole, but at least we can go with that for the moment. So in this case, if I look at G naught naught, this is what I get. Okay, I'm not expecting that to be particularly helpful, but I'm going to try and work with this to get somewhere where I end up with my higher dimensional black hole. So I'd rather use area gauge. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say that C equals R, a new R radial coordinate. And I'm just going to set, for the moment, and this is an assumption, I'm going to set dr equals d little r is capital dr over A. Okay? I suppose I could set it to be, actually, let me set it to be B, because I don't think I need, A doesn't appear. Let me call it B. So that's sort of harking back to that first calculation we did for spherically symmetric solutions, except I think I probably would have had the B being upstairs, on the numerator rather than on the denominator. So in that case, what that's saying, if C is R, And in this case, my d by dr is simply, d by d capital R is simply b times d by d little r. So this tells me c primed is b. So I use that and go back to looking at what g naught naught is. I actually see that it's really very, very similar to what I had in four dimensions. And the only thing that's different is the fact that I've taken 1 over b instead of b. So this, by now, if I multiply both sides by r to the d minus 2 and assume I've got a higher dimensional Einstein equation, then this is what I get. It's very similar to what we had in four dimensions. So here we're assuming an Einstein equation. So g naught naught would be 8 pi g rho. And I've just rearranged the terms on the right-hand side as a total derivative. So this now means I can read off what my radial solution is, which is somewhere over here. Well, I haven't said, I mean, this is what it is. I've just rearranged it at the boat. Well, g naught naught is 8 pi g, so we still have the same, we're still assuming the same Einstein action. So let me just finish this, let me finish the argument, and then I'll say a few words about normalization of the Newton constant, because that's also an interesting thing to comment on in higher dimensions. So at the moment, I'm assuming the Einstein equation, okay? I'm not actually saying, I haven't derived it or said anything about it. So here, this tells me that my b squared, in general, is going to be so if rho is 0, this says that b squared can be 1, and it could also have an 1 over r to the d minus 3 term. So that's in vacuum. But then, in general, my r plus to the d minus 3 if I wasn't in vacuum, this r plus to the d minus 3 would kind of change, would be dependent on r, depending on whether this integral was evolving. So you can kind of see that this looks like the integral we had before. But what's not true now is that we don't have 4 pi r squared being the area of the d minus 2 sphere. So this integral here, if I want to associate this integral with a mass function, if I keep my 16 pi g for the moment, rho times r to the d minus 2 would be the right function to integrate if I multiplied it by the area of a d minus 2 sphere. So this if I want to write this as a mass function, I have to sort of divide by a to the d minus 2. So it tells me that in d dimensions, my mass function, m of r, or the overall mass, let me say, is d minus 2, a d minus 2, r plus the d minus 3 over 16 pi g. So it looks a little more complicated, in higher dimensions than it did for Schwarzschild, but not an awful lot more complicated. The constants that are multiplying are just simple geometric constants that have, you know, a reason for being there. So that tells us that our, if we just want to, sort of summarize this, our higher dimensional black hole dropping the capital R. It's very similar to Schwarzschild. We simply take the 1 over R, which would be the solution to a Laplace equation in three dimensions, and it goes to 1 over R to the D minus 3, which is our solution to the Laplace equation in D minus 1 dimensions. So it looks very similar. We have a potential, 1 over the potential in the area gauge. And the only thing that's slightly different is our expression for the mass, kind of relating the mass to that root of the horizon, is just a little bit more complicated. So R plus is again a horizon. And you do exactly the same construction to get Kruskal's and to extend beyond the event horizon. And so you have exactly the same Penrose diagram for this higher dimensional Schwarzschild black hole. We can also calculate the temperature. Again, using this Euclidean technique. So I'm going to label this potential here as V. And so the way that our metric approaches the event horizon, we simply do a Taylor expansion. The event horizon is where V goes to zero. So near R plus, our potential is linear R minus R plus times the derivative at R plus of V. So that's what we do. And once again, we say that, this doesn't make sense to me what I've written down here, but never mind. We find that we redefine our radial coordinate, again, to be like the square root of R minus R plus. I think there's probably a 4 in there. And then we find that the Euclidean time has a periodicity again. This time it's 4 pi over V plus primed. So that tells me my temperature, T, which is V plus primed over 4 pi, so you get this dimension-dependent factor here. So once again, black holes have negative specific heat, but the sort of different, the dependences are just very slightly different. So black holes can also rotate, but in fact, there's a lot more things they can do in more than four dimensions. In three dimensions, there's kind of only one invariant axis. So roughly speaking, when you do rotation and you try and sort of split it out into commuting subgroups, rotation in a plane is sort of the basic thing that characterizes rotation. So in three dimensions, you can only pack in one two-dimensional plane, and then that gives you a rotation in a plane with an axis. In four dimensions, you can kind of build them up out of two orthogonal planes, and you could, in principle, have rotation in each of those two planes separately, and those two would be kind of independent. So there's more than just one possible angular momentum eigenvalue that you can have once you go to higher dimensions. They can be a lot more complicated. I'm just going to write down a very simple one, which is rotation in a single plane. And I'll write it down so you can see what's similar and what's different occur. Sorry, that's sine theta, not sine squared theta. So these sigmas, the sigma's the same as it was before. The delta, on the other hand, is kind of the analogous thing to, R squared plus A squared minus 2 GMR, you've now got the different potential. But you can kind of see that what you've done here is that you split up the space that you've sort of picked out two of the angular directions, the theta phi. So in other words, the plane in which you're rotating. So in four dimensions, you've got your sort of three-dimensional space, and you pick out the phi direction that you rotate with respect to. Here you've got, in your D minus one-dimensional space, you're selecting a single plane, and you're splitting up your D minus two sphere into a sort of sine squared theta times d phi squared, and then a cos squared theta times the remainder here of the d minus 4 directions. So this bit, the rotating bit, looks just like Kerr, but you've kind of bolted on an extra d minus 4 sphere. So these solutions were found in the 80s by Myers and Perry, so Rob's here, of course, at Perimeter, and Malcolm is at Cambridge. So at the time, of course, I think they were both in the US. So they went through finding general solutions for black holes in higher dimensions. So they refound this solution. This was first found by Kotler back, 1920 plus or minus 3 years. And so they rediscovered that, and then talked about temperatures, found out about rotation, discussed how the mass depended on this event horizon radius, and basically worked out pretty much anything you might want to know about black holes in higher dimensions in Einstein gravity. So let me just return to, I think, one of the questions I had, just to sort of make a comment about Einstein gravity in higher dimensions. So if we want to take our gravity in higher dimensions, the obvious thing that we want to do is to carry on using the Einstein action. So I'm going to just ignore boundary terms because they're not really relevant for this discussion. But the Einstein-Hilbert action was 1 over 16 pi g integral dx root g r. So that was our Einstein action. It was the integral of the Ricci scalar. If we go to higher dimensions, that's still an absolutely natural thing to consider. And again, if we think about, for example, a Lagrangian for a scalar field in higher dimensions, we would have exactly the same discussion that we had when we looked at that in four dimensions with the same relation to the energy momentum tensor. So what's actually different here? Well, if I change the dimensionality of my space, if I think about what are the dimensions, so doing a dimensional analysis, if I've set h bar to 1, I expect my action to be dimensionless. So if I set h bar and c to 1, I'm setting everything but one dimension to 1. So this case, the dimensions of my Newton's constant in d equals 4 are l squared. So if I now look at what happens here, the dimensions of the Ricci scalar, well, that's curvature. What's curvature? I have to take, if I look at my Cartan up there, I've taken d of my basis, or d of the metric, to get the connection. So that's like the connection has got dimensions inverse length, and then d of that to get curvature. So the dimensions of curvature are, the curvature scalar are e to, l to the minus 2. So I've kind of taken two derivatives. So it's like a kinetic term. And then the dimensions of my sort of measure, integral measure, are l to the d. So what that means is, in d dimensions, the Newton's constant has dimensions l to the d minus 2. So in other words, Newton, you know, it's probably better to think of it more as the gravitational constant. It's something that is kind of dimension dependent. So we still write this. So this is what defines our Einstein equations. We write this, we get the same Einstein equations. Einstein tensor is 8 pi gt. But what we mean by g is sort of changes in dimensionality. So the only reason that we're kind of a bit more careful about this now is previously we often used to set h bar c and g to 1 when doing gravity. So we'd have the Schwarzschild solution as 1 minus 2 m on r. If you're always within the same number of dimensions, that's okay, because you have a unique Planck scale in that number of dimensions. But what this is saying is, if you change the number of dimensions, then your Planck scale could, in principle, be different. So what we're going to do next week is we're going to look at kind of different ways you can go from a higher dimensional space to 4 dimensions. And in that case, we have to relate a higher dimensional Newton constant to our 4-dimensional Newton constant. And so that means we're multiplying by something dimensionful, something with a volume. And that could, unless that Planck scale in higher dimensions is identical to the Planck scale in 4 dimensions, we're then going to get a hierarchy between g in higher dimensions and g in 4 dimensions. So that's coming back to your question, which is kind of, you know, it's a good question. It's sort of got some interesting stuff behind it. But, you know, it could be relevant. It kind of depends. So so typically we define g in 4 dimensions as gn, the Newton constant. That's sort of specifically what we're calling Newton's constant. And of course we know gravity in 4 dimensions is very weak. But this is sort of one way in which we can actually make gravity in 4 dimensions be much weaker than gravity in higher dimensions. So I just want to sort of finish off by at least discussing what, so far I've just really talked about vacuum solutions. And I just want to sort of quickly say what other solutions you can have. So we can have higher dimensional charge solutions. So I kind of hinted at this when I was talking about p-forms. And basically, we build these. We build charge, extended charge solutions using p-forms. So so maybe this will be slight. I think when I first talked about the p-forms, it probably was just, what? What on earth is that? So I'll kind of say some of the same things again, but you know, maybe it'll sort of be a bit more transparent this time. So when we build a charge solution in four dimensions, the Riesen and Nordstrom solution, basically, in four dimensions, we have a black hole could be electrically charged, and that's where it couples directly to A mu, or rather A naught. So our Maxwell gauge field has a sort of standard electrostatic potential. But we can also have magnetic solutions, where we have a sort of F theta phi is Q. So we have this notion of a magnetic charge. But that's really essentially saying that if I were to define star, if I looked at the dual of F, then that would look like, that would sort of have a T component, which would sort of be looking like Q on R. So either our solution is charged directly under the p-form or kind of under its dual, and that gives us a sort of magnetic solution. So in this case, if I have a two-form, I could take sort of B TZ or something. So this would be a BTZ of R, then that would correspond to an extended solution which would be a string, and we would say it was electrically charged. So in terms of that extended metric up there, I'd be looking for a solution with a dt and a dz, so p would be 2, and in that case, m would be whatever it needed to be, dependent on the dimensionality of my space-time. For a magnetic b charge, so the field strength of b is h, which is db, and I'd sort of expect that to be sort of Q times a sort of d theta wedge, sort of sine theta d phi wedge, sort of sine theta sine phi d chi, or basically the area form on a three sphere. And so this would give us a magnetic brain. So if I was in 10 dimensions, this would be a 5 brain. It would have 5 spatial dimensions. And so there's one particular solution, one of these charged brains, that's kind of quite important, and I just want to finish off by writing it down. And that is what, it's a five brain, sorry, the three brain, I'm thinking of five from that one, which is charged under a field strength that's self-dual. So what would that mean in the context of Reissner and Nordström? The dual of our Maxwell field strength, the Maxwell field strength is a two-form. The dual of it in four dimensions is also a two-form. So that's why you can get both electric and magnetically charged black holes under the same sort of electromagnetism. And so you could imagine a dyon, which would be something which had both electric and magnetic charge. And if both of those charges were the same, then you could think of your black hole as being kind of self-dual. And so in this case, it's the same idea, but it's in 10 dimensions. So our field strength, F5, is something like so in this case, this would be TR, so our, we sort of have a volume form on the sort of G and R space, and then we have the gamma space would be like an S5. So in this case, our charge so what I'm writing down here is the analog of a non-extremal charged black hole. So this was, these solutions were found by Horowitz and Strominger. I mean, not just this one, but a whole, basically almost everything you could ever build with the various different P forms that you get in string theory. But sending R plus to R minus gives what's called the D3 brain. And that's actually quite an important solution in the context of string theory. So if we just kind of look at this, it's written in a slightly different form. But if I can just deconstruct it, here we've got an omega 5, and remember, if that was the dimensionality of this gamma space, then if I think about what is my potential, the Schwarzschild potential, then that would be, so d minus 2 is 5, so d minus 3 is 4, so that's why I'm getting 1 over r to the fourths here in my potential. So the specific kind of behavior, the reason that it's not quite the same as the building block, is more because what we've done is we've now got some field strength. So we've actually got a source. This isn't so much a vacuum solution. But it's at least giving the idea that we can not only find vacuum solutions in higher dimensions, but we can also add in extra sources, and we can construct a much broader family of solutions to gravity in higher dimensions.